welcome to the Pocket Gamer Podcast. It's episode number 415. My name remains James Gilmore. And joining me today is the twin duo pairing, that's a bunch of redundancy for you, of Emily Soden.
Hi.
And Glenn Fox.
Actually, my name's changed, James.
Oh, good. Mixing it up. What are we this week, Glenn?
I'm Edge Maverick from Star Ocean 4.
Wow. That's a...
Yeah.
Very specific.
It's a deep pull.
It's coming out again on PS4 next month, so I'm celebrating by changing my name to Edge Maverick.
Okay, cool. Because you live by nobody's rules but your own?
That's true, yeah. I don't need to tell the government or update it or anything. I just need to say it, and now it's gospel. It's a thing.
Oh, they love you down the tax office, don't they?
Oh, they love it, yeah.
Good old Edge, they say.
Glenn? They're like, that's on your birth certificate. I'm like, who needs a birth certificate?
I live on the edge, brackets, Maverick.
Yeah.
That's how he rolls.
I like it.
I've just ruined Glenn's life by telling him that the Diet Coke that he's drinking is destroying his body and looks like tar when boiled.
Yeah, he did do that. And now I'm trying not to think of that while drinking the delicious syrupy tar that is Diet Coke.
I suggest you all, if you have Google nearby, give it a look. It's quite an eye-opening video and might well put you off the whole Coke beverage thing like it did me. I don't want it in me, Glenn.
I don't want it in me. I don't want to know. I'd rather wait till later. I'd rather have found out like 2 hours' time when it's already digested and gone. Actually, it probably wouldn't have been. It would have actually been tar then. God, this is horrible.
Yeah, stuck to your intestines for at least 6 months.
It's like bubble gum.
It is. Like, it just lives inside you. Anyway, how's everybody else? I'm drinking nice green tea. What are you drinking?
I had a coffee.
Yeah, good. That's still good. It's black, but it's less tarry. We still win, Glenn, and that's what's important. Sorry, Edge.
It's true. Thanks for getting it right.
Nice. So, this week, then, we've got a lot as usual. I always say that, but it never stops being true. We're going to be talking about the Nintendo update for the Switch, which brings recording with it, which none of us have tried. Fruit Ninja is going on to a different platform. What platform? The cardboard platform. More on that in a bit. Doom, impending doom, not just because of our country and our terrible politics, but actual doom onto new consoles. Plus, new releases including the likes of Warhammer Quest 2 and Push from the Clocky lot. And I talked to Jonathan Blow, the designer behind The Witness and Braid Before It, about what it takes to make one of these very intense 8-year-long development cycle puzzle games for smart people. But first, the news. Nintendo continues to roll out its suite updates for the Nintendo Switch. It's got more volume now from one of the older updates, and now the ability to record a video. Now, I wasn't 100% on this whole recording thing, because is this recording footage what you have on screen at that minute, I assume? Because the Switch hasn't got a camera, right?
No, it's got sensors, but that's about as far as it got.
It's got sensors. What kind of sensors? Heat sensors? Like motion sensors?
All of the above. It watches you in your house.
Oh, God.
No, just like, you know, your motion sensory things. I expect this will work, you know, like PlayStation's Record Play, where you can, like, record, I think it's up to 30 seconds.
Right,
and then share it via social media, you know, the huge.
Yes, it looks like you're right, having now done some actual research. You capture footage by holding down the screenshot capture button, and away you go. It records. I've seen some stuff on the Twitter saying it's a bit dodgy, this, and it only works with a few games at the moment, like four games specifically.
Yeah, like the main few, like Mario Kart and Splatoon and that lot.
Yes, where people might want to do replays of a thing they just did. So yeah, you can do that. Plus, they've added a whole bunch of new things, like a bunch more icons, 12 you can choose from, and it lets you transfer data from one device to another. It's not cloud saves yet, as you've pointed out in the article, but, you know, sort of getting there. So nice to know that they haven't forgotten about the Switch just yet. In fact, it sold more, I read somewhere, than the PS4 and the Xbox One in the last month.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's impressive. So Switch continues to perform. Impressive little bit of kit. I still don't have it, and I still want it. Now, enough of this newfangled technology. Let's talk about card games. Fruit Ninja is being turned into not one, but three cardboard-based board games.
Right, I don't understand this.
Neither do I. How can
they do one? Tell me, James. I need to know.
That was my question. When you're talking about a Twitch-based video game, which is all about slicing fruit in half on a screen, that's the point of Fruit Ninja. That's what makes it cool, is because the fruit appears, and you can swipe, and you see it go, wha-pam, and fly in half. That's it. That's the game. Unless it's a very expensive game where you buy a new deck of cards every time, and everyone just grabs the cards and tears them in half and throws them away, which would be thrilling, I admit, but... You know, you'd need a lot of cards and new packs all the time. It's not that at all. It's a Kickstarter thing. It's $10,000 that they're looking for. And there's three of them. And judging by the videos and stuff, it does have a real-time aspect to it. So it's like a card-matching game, at least one of them is.
That's how I thought it would be.
Yeah, you're throwing down cards and you have to do this at speed. And then people have to be like, snap, or... fruit or whatever. I don't know. Guava. And then they win a thing. They win a banana or something. I don't know. Okay. It wasn't clear. But it just was like, right, okay, I didn't realise this was a thing we wanted. But $10,000 not that much on the Kickstarter circuit nowadays. And Fruit Ninja is such a massive global thing. They'll probably get it made.
The thing is, it's not like they've gone for like an overly complicated idea.
Mm.
So a lot of people will be able to just hop on board and be like, yep, I understand this, I can do this, this should be fun at parties and for getting drunk and things.
Yeah. Yeah, not my parties. But
no, not mine.
But I'm sure it's for somebody. Which led me to think, what card games should we have from mobile games? We've already had things like the Angry Birds physical games, where you can actually get a little plastic Angry Bird and a plastic catapult and go twang! And launch it at something.
That sounds dangerous.
It is. It really is. But what would work then from the big mobile brands as a physical game?
What about a Banner Saga board game?
Banner Saga board. That would work because it's got... Well, it's already tactical, you know, turn-based thing, wouldn't it?
It'd be kind of like a light Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah. Yeah, it would. In fact, thinking about it, those Telltale-style games, or any of those games that have choice trees, if you like, where you have to, you know, choose one answer or another, they would work, because they are basically choose-your-own-adventures, and we've had them around since the 80s. So those kind of games, where as long as someone's prepared to DM it, you know, and run it and provide the answers to the questions, those would work as physical games.
Mm-hmm.
I think Clash of Clans would be, nah. Clash Royale, that wouldn't work. What are the big stuff? You think of anything, Glenn?
Candy Crush. Why not? That definitely wouldn't work, would it?
They've made a show of it.
A show?
Have they?
Like a
cartoon?
Yeah,
they did.
How you guys have forgotten that? They've made like the game show in the States, and it's hosted by, what's his face, from Saved by the Bell.
I didn't know this. They've made a game show based on Candy Crush.
Yeah, yeah. It was like, oh my god, it's been in the news for like a year, James.
It's really weird because you can, like, it's Candy Crush as you play it normally, but you're swinging from a rope and it's a giant Candy Crush screen.
What?
I'm thinking the right thing, aren't I, Emily?
Yeah, I think so. It's like a total mixture of a bunch of different already existing games. Like,
I'm sorry,
I'm Castle, or not.
I'm Googling this. This has not popped up on my radar. Oh my, what?
Best reaction ever.
This is Mario Lopez. Mario Lopez from Saved by the Bell.
Yeah,
the buff
one.
The buff one with the curly hair.
Yep.
Oh, my word. Oh, he's on daytime TV and he's talking about it. Oh, this is the end of civilization, isn't it? That's what this is.
I actually kind of want to watch it. You can't deny that you kind of want to watch it a little bit.
Wow, Mario Lopez has aged well.
I know, yeah. He's very handsome, bless him.
He doesn't look a day older. Same can't be said for old Screech, though. Didn't end well for him, did it? Oh, dear. No, no, no. Anyway, Fruit Ninja, the card game, if you want to go and get it, or any of the three of them, you have to fund it first, so you can find the campaign over there on Kickstarter. But if you like your action a little bit more digital and a lot more violent than chopping fruit in half, is ripping demons' limbs off. And that's what you can do in Doom, which is heading to the Nintendo Switch. We already knew this, but it's coming a lot sooner than we thought. November 10th is going to be the launch date for Switch Doom. Are we hype for this?
Yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
I have mixed feelings. Because, basically, when I first heard about it, I was like, cool. We're getting like a serious, big, gory brown shooter on the Switch. Like, long may this continue. And then right. I saw, like, I think it was Does It Digital Foundry who did the sort of test with it.
Yes.
They had, like, a few minutes to 30 minutes something to play with it. And they basically found that it's, like, for a start, it's 30 frames per second rather than 60. And I don't have a problem with 30 frames per second, but Doom was kind of like, it's supposed to be, like, a super fast, slick, smooth shooter, right?
Yeah.
And like, halving the frames per second is only going to change it, not for the better. And then also the, like, background visuals are really pared back. And it's, again, gorgeous game, and I don't know if I'd want to play it, a low-res version of it. I don't mean to be harsh to the Switch here, because I love the Switch, and I know what it's capable of, and I know what it's not capable of. And I just know there are some games that are just simply not going to work on it, and that's fine. Like, we don't need every single game to come to Switch, but... So I'm kind of confused why Doom was the one they chose.
Yeah. See, I've played through Doom. I completed Doom. I really enjoyed it. I liked the 2016 remake, and...
I liked it too, yeah.
It is one of those ones where I'll agree with you there. I'm not fussed about frame rates either, but it's fast. It's super fast. It's, like I say, skating on a lake of fire fast, and that was part of what makes it very, very thrilling. And it maybe won't have quite that same, I don't know, thrill that you get, or you won't feel that same kind of sharpness if it's running at 30. And like I say, I don't care if a game runs at 30. Destiny's fine at 30 because it's not very fast, but this is super, super, super fast, and that did add to the experience a bit. The other thing for me is that it is one of those murky-ass games where everything's a bit red and everything's a bit brown and a bit yellow, and when you're playing on mobile stuff especially, unless you're in a darkened room, for me, Doom is a bit of a big screen and nasty grungy graphics and kind of soundtrack and all of that. And trying to play Doom like on a bench out in the sunshine, I was like, I'm not going to be able to see anything in this murk, and you're going to be hearing like through tiny little speakers. And I'm not sure that's going to be... I mean, I'm not for no problem with it being there, and I'd gladly play it. If I hadn't played it for the first time, you know, if I hadn't already played it, rather, then great. More people get to play Doom. I think it's a good game. But I'm not sure it's the perfect platform for it.
Bethesda's got, like, loads of games that would have probably been a much better fit. Because they're obviously just keen on getting stuff out on the Switch as quickly as possible.
Mm.
Why not, like, The Evil Within or Fallout 4? Like, if Skyrim can work on it, why not a pared-back version of Fallout 4?
Don't they fall into the same trap, though, of, like, dirgy-looking, sort of quite monochromatic games that don't necessarily lend themselves to mobile play? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so. But, I mean, like, if they're going to throw games on the platform anymore, they might as well just pick games that work. Like, even the original Dishonored, why not that? It's, you know, it was built for the last gen anyway, so it would fit nicely on the Switch. Like, because it's obviously just a cash grab. And not that there's anything wrong with that. Like, I'm all for just chucking older games on Switch so I can play them again. But I'm just baffled by their choices. Like, Wolfenstein 2 coming out on all the big platforms. It's going to be gorgeous. It's going to be a big, ambitious shooter. And then Doom, which is already that. And you look back at the back catalogue and you're like, oh yeah, there's that. There's loads of these games that they could have just chucked on there.
I think Evil Within 2's already tanked a little bit. I'm playing Evil Within again. I only got about sort of 5-10 hours in the first time. I didn't take to it. I'm trying it again on the PS Pro with the better frame rates and everything. I'm determined to try and like it because there's not enough good horror kicking around. Is there one of these ones you'd like to see, Em? Are you interested in a Doom on Switch now that you have a Switch and can play it?
I'd be interested to see what they could possibly bring, if you know what I mean. Like, I think Bethesda's like bringing the type of games that people want to play to the platform, and I think they're just kind of testing it out a little bit. So I would be interested to get more open world things on the Switch for sure.
Okay.
Because I do love me open world. And ironically, I'm not very good at the open world stuff, like when I'm sitting down playing PlayStation or on my PC or something. Mm-hmm. But on the Switch, I absolutely love it because I can take it with me to like coffee shops and stuff, so I don't feel as bad.
Right. Is it the time investment thing? Because you have to, if you're anchored to a couch in your house, open world games are quite time intensive.
Yeah, and it's the convenience of it all. Like I said, was it last week when I said about, you know, Stardew Valley, you can just kind of close down the thingy and you're exactly where you left off.
Yeah, yeah.
With open world stuff, you know, you don't have to get to the next checkpoint or things like that. You just pause it, shut it down for a second, go off, do your thing, you know, stop in a coffee shop, have a coffee, pop your headphones in, take your Switch out and play another 10 minutes before you have to go home.
Mm.
Yeah, I agree with Emily there. Something about open world games that you kind of just want to dip in and dip out at your leisure. And when you when it's on the big screen, you can obviously only do it when you're at your TV. So when it's in your bag, whap it out because you're waiting and go and look in a dungeon or something.
Whap it out and look in a dungeon.
That's what I do, James.
Oh, I never wanted a Switch so bad. Well, November 10th is when you can get your hands on the Doom. We still haven't got the release date for Skyrim yet, that other Bethesda thingy.
I thought we did have a date for Skyrim.
Do we?
It's like November 11th or something, isn't it?
Oh, well, shut my mouth. You're getting double Bethesda'd then.
To be fair, I do want L.A. Noire on the Switch for sure.
No, to be fair, yeah, Nintendo gets Doom, Skyrim and L.A. Noire within 7 days. Jesus. A good week for the Switch. We often see PC and console games making the journey over to mobile, but few seem to fit as well as The Witness, the most recent game from creator Jonathan Blow. I'm being joined today by Jonathan over in Seattle. Good morning to you, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Good morning to you.
As I mentioned in the intro there, we do see lots of console games coming over onto mobile. Some of them do feel like they've been crowbarred on often, that you feel the absence of either control pads or mouse and keyboard setups, and the touchscreen controls often feel like a compromise. Given the line-drawing, maze-like nature of the majority of the puzzles in The Witness, some of those almost feel like they've been designed with touchscreen and mobile in mind. Is this in any way true?
It is. You know, we always knew that we were going to come to touchscreens a little bit later because we're a small company and we can only manage targeting so many platforms at once. But it was in my mind from the beginning of designing the game that this would end up on mobile devices. I was thinking about iPads specifically back then because I like the nice big screen. But now, you know, we started this game a while ago, and so the phones were much smaller on average back then too.
We're talking like it was 7 years ago or something, wasn't it? Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I really, you know, I started the very beginnings of the game in 2008.
Wow. Okay.
But we didn't actually go into production on it till about this time in 2009. So okay. It would be 8 years ago today.
Man.
Which is still a long time. So, you know, some things changed about the devices and all that over that time. But we always had it in mind that we would come there. And, you know, we didn't know exactly how. I knew that I wanted controls that weren't the general low effort controls that people do, you know, like the like if something was designed for consoles with game pads or something, they'll put like the virtual sticks on the screen.
Yeah.
And those, I mean, you can move around with those, but it doesn't seem like a natural fit for the device to me. And so I didn't want to do that.
I'm notoriously averse to those kind of controls on touchscreen. They do feel very much like it's the obvious sort of thing when you go, oh, we'll just put two floating sticks there, but without physical feedback and just a flat screen, it always feels a bit awkward.
No, they're terrible. Same for me with like virtual buttons. Like if you're playing a game where you're supposed to hit buttons really fast and they're like a button in a fixed place on the screen, I think that's terrible. Funnily enough, we get some comments from people who play the game that we don't give them virtual sticks and can they have that? And I think they're a little bit Stockholm syndromed into that. Like, you know, people want what they know or something.
Force of habit. For people who haven't played it, by the way, it works via touching on the ground in front of the character. It's a first person game. And then you will just walk to that point. So you're kind of dropping navigation points with your finger.
Yeah. And there's some additional controls. So you can like two finger hold to like step around in a localized area, sort of sidestep and forward and back and stuff.
Yeah.
Double tap to run, that kind of thing. So back some years ago, before Infinity Blade, Epic had done a demo called, I think it was called Epic Citadel. It was not really a game. It was just like a 3D environment that you could walk around. And it was pretty impressive for the time because it was one of the first times that somebody had done full 3D on mobile like that. And they had a pretty interesting interface. They had a really simple kind of tap-to-move interface on there. It was kind of dumb. It would just like walk in a straight line toward whatever surface you tapped on. But they also had virtual sticks in there, and I found the tap-to-move much nicer than the virtual sticks, with the caveats that in that demo, you weren't trying to do anything specific, so you didn't need to be very precise about what you were doing.
I think that's one of the reasons it works well here. I find when they've tried to employ this technique in combat games, where you're forced to kind of be on the run or turn around very quickly and move around like that, it's a little less easy to maneuver. Whereas here, because you are just exploring by the nature of the game, you're not, there's not this kind of time pressure on you to quick do it quickly. You can just go to the place you want to go.
Exactly.
Well, the actual world itself is a wordless one. It's a world where you're expected to explore, as I say, at your own leisure. You're not really given any pointers or any instructions or sort of nav points or anything. It's just a case of just go. And now it's been out for obviously a while, and it had a sort of very good critical reception, and I'm sure it generated a mixture of love and ire, depending on who you talk to, because is it fair to say it's not for everyone?
Oh, absolutely. And I knew that going in, you know, at the very beginning of designing it. And, you know, I'm in a little bit of a different business than a lot of people who make video games. I'm not really trying to make the game that appeals to the most people, right? I'm trying to make the game that appeals the most to some set of people, right? Or the game that, not even that appeals, that's the most interesting experience that I know how to make.
Sure.
And then I hope that there's some audience of people who will appreciate the same kind of thing that I do, and that that audience of people is large enough to, like, keep us in business, because we are a games development company.
Yeah.
But we're not, you know, like all these microtransaction game people, their goal is just to maximize the revenue number, and that's not what we're doing at all. So, so I knew, not only with the high concept of the game, that a lot of people wouldn't get it, or you know, would think like, this is weird. Why would I play this? It's not like anything that I know about. But then also there's many decisions within the game. You know, there are some puzzles or some things that happen that we know are a little bit aggravating, like intentionally, because there's just a spectrum of experience in the game. It's not about trying to give you the most smoothed over, most shallow fun for the whole time. And, you know, of course, some people really appreciate that, you know. So, there's some people who say this is the best game I've ever played. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And there's some people who say this is terrible. I don't understand why anyone would play this. And I think anytime you do something really interesting, you're going to get a reception like that. So, like, looking at our scores, of course, reviewers review the game, and we have scores that run from, you know, 10.0 out of 10 on the high side to like 4 out of 10 on the low side. Whereas 4 out of 10 is traditionally reserved for a game that doesn't even function, right? Like, you try to run it and it crashes all the time or something.
And you fall through the floor, and that's what we're talking about.
No, and this game works fine. It's just that's how upset it made some people, you know?
Which is kind of nice in a way. I think you're right. A lot of the, I hesitate to say art, but you know what I mean. Like, if we're talking about music and movies, if you look at those things and they have a very strong split where people tend to, oh, I absolutely adore this, or I despise it. I can think of directors like Nicholas Winding Refn, and there's a fan base that really vibrate at the same frequency as that guy. And then the rest of them go, I have no idea what you see in this. This is completely superficial nonsense, and I hate it. And that's kind of an interesting space to occupy, I think, as a creator.
Yeah, I mean, I think what exactly that space is probably different for every person. Like, I know I can think of directors, I don't know the particular one you mentioned, but I can think of directors like that. And some of them, I genuinely think, oh, what this person makes is not that interesting, right?
Yeah.
And then other ones are very interesting. So I don't wish to say that that kind of judgment is always wrong when people look at something and say, oh, this is nonsense or whatever. Sometimes that judgment, I think, is right. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to make games that are certainly far from superficial.
It's interesting what you mentioned about the monetary aspect, because we've got a lot of stuff with microtransactions trickling into console gaming now. Obviously, they kind of started out on mobile in many ways. It was the testing ground for it, and it's the model that now the console industry is adopting. And not that there weren't microtransactions on PC before, the likes of Team Fortress, but it's become very, very popularized now. And a lot of the pushback people are saying, they're objecting to it on a consumer level, but at the same time, developers are saying, well, the budgets have gotten so big now that just the game price alone, your $60 up front isn't going to cut it. If you're making a game like this, which isn't going to indulge in that kind of stuff, and you're aware that your audience is more targeted, perhaps small. You're not going for the broad strokes of every Call of Duty player, for example. Does that affect the way in which you develop it to a degree? I mean, managing your time, managing budgets, that sort of thing.
Well, I do think it certainly impacts the budget level very heavily, you know. You know, The Witness was a game that is pretty expensive for a small independent game. And so that made it a little bit audacious to make such a risky, weird, unidentifiable game at that budget level.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that budget level is very small compared to, well, for example, a AAA PC or console. Those budgets can often be around $100 million, which is much, much higher than what we had. Much higher. So naturally, you don't want to lose your $100 million. That's a lot to lose. And so people tend to be a lot more riskier, or a lot less risky, sorry, a lot more conservative with design in those cases.
Because often I find that certainly a lot of games that I like and art in general, it's born of restriction. It's that whole mother of invention cliche. Do you think it actually helps you in some ways?
I do think there's something to that point about restriction that people may... I mean, in what you're saying, I hear an echo of something that I've heard before, right? That, that restriction helps the creative process. I think that's probably true. That's not something that I have introspected on specifically enough with regard to myself.
Right.
Because usually I think my ideas come with a little bit of restriction built in. I'm already playing on a genre or something. So Braid was kind of a play on a 2D Mario kind of a game. And, you know, that already gives you a set form that determines a lot of things. And then the creativity happens within that form. And so the same with The Witness, to a little bit of a looser degree, was, you know, more like a mist exploring an island.
Yeah.
Kind of a game. And that gave me, of course, it was a much looser play on that form in The Witness, but it gave enough structure. I think if you're totally unstructured and you could just do anything, then sometimes it is hard to know what you're doing. It's not magic. It's not like you just have a lot of money and then you wave a wand and the game is much bigger with super high production values or whatever.
Sure.
Right? There's a process that has to happen involving a lot of people, like hundreds of people. And the problem is that turns my job from designing a game into managing an army and keeping them on target, which is hard. It's a really hard problem. And so even if you solve that problem well enough to get people to make the game, it's hard to make precisely the game you wanted, right? So imagine you're using some precision tool to carve out the shape of the game that you want, and you have some very delicate shape in mind, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm trying to make this exact thing. Okay, if you have like a scalpel or a pen knife or something, you can maybe do a very careful job, right? But if you come along with like an electric buzzsaw that's like a big two-hand held thing, you're going to be able to saw a lot more wood with that, but you're going to have a much harder problem making a precise, delicate shape.
Sure.
The big team is a lot more like the electric buzzsaw.
Do you feel it's difficult to give up control to a degree? Because, as you say, as the team grows, as it becomes an army, you wind up at a situation where you are that many stages more removed from people who are doing certain tasks. Are you a controlling person? Do you like to have 100% authorship of everything? Or do you like kind of collaborating with a wide range?
I am not one of those controlling personalities. I know people who are, and that actually is useful in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
It's also got its own drawbacks. But there are things that I don't ever budge on with regard to games. So the way I see it is, you know, the game has a certain idea behind it, behind what it is. And that idea has to maintain integrity throughout the whole development process. You know, one of the things people say about my games is they like them because they feel like a coherent whole, like everything matches everything else and belongs. And that doesn't happen by accident. You have to make sure that stays that way. So on the one hand, I have to let people have a lot of creative freedom, because even on a game the size of The Witness, I can't have enough ideas to fill out the game between, you know, puzzle ideas and thematic ideas and backstory ideas and then, you know, visual ideas like what should the art direction be like and how should it be executed technically, because that determines how it looks. And then what should all these locations be and how exactly should this building be shaped and, you know, whatever. What's the environmental unspoken backstory behind how this building came to be on this island? So all those things, there's too much there for one person to do. And so you have to let other people do that and give them the freedom to be creative about it, because that's how you get the best work, is when people are interested and creative about it. But often they will come up with things that don't fit and that would ruin the game a little bit or tarnish it a little bit if they go in. And so my job is to be the bad guy who says no in those cases and even says, we're going to do this over. I know you worked on this, but we're going to do it over again for the fourth time now, because it's still not right. And then eventually it works out. And that's, you know, that's one of the reasons why development took so long, is because we were being very meticulous about that kind of thing.
When it comes to the nonverbal nature of the storytelling that you've got going on here, I mean, I know there's a reason why I like that particular kind of storytelling, and anything from, I don't know, Machinarium, the Amanita Design games, where these, you know, point-and-click adventures which just do everything purely through visuals and little noises and bleeps and bloops. And it's a lovely way of getting you to engage on a slightly different level, and secondly, to take advantage of the medium that you're working in. For you, you've chosen to, you know, let this island speak for itself to some degree. What's your aim with that? Why not throw up words?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's a general game design philosophy of mine to do that, right? It's more a specific thing that we did for this game, because that's just what the game wanted. You know, it's a game about observing what's around you and noticing things that are important and understanding why they're there and what they mean. It's all, the Witness is an intensely internal game. Right. You know, there's, the controls don't even do that much, right? You know, you can't like jump, you can't hold items and use them, which almost every adventure game in the history of adventure games you can do, right?
Yeah.
So that implies certain things. So for example, there's no music in the game, right? There's not like a rocking music track that happens when you enter a new area like most games would have.
Right.
And the reason why is because that conflicts with the notion that you're supposed to be paying attention to things that are actually in your environment, right? Superimposing things from the outside is the opposite of that. And, you know, when it comes to in-game storytelling type stuff, my original idea for the game was actually going to have a very, let's say, obvious story that, or not, I don't mean obvious in a bad way, but like easy to find story bits that were very frequent. So in the sort of classic way that you find audio logs sitting around and you kind of get a radio play that plays out. It just, over the course of making the game, I just realized that that was the wrong thing for this game. The game needed to be quieter. So the recordings that there are mostly not that, and they're mostly hidden, and you would have to, you know, you probably won't see most of them unless you're deliberately hunting for them.
And are you a fan of the touchscreen format in general? Because initially, years ago, granted, but it got a lot of resistance from people, and there's still that stigma of mobile games aren't real games, and you know, you hear a lot of that kicking around at the moment.
Well, I do think there are some challenges, but part of the challenge is just that you have to design something that's meant to be played on a touchscreen, right?
Yes.
And The Witness is not even the ideal of that. I mean, we definitely put a great deal of work into making it controllable on the touchscreen, but it wasn't a game designed solely and exclusively to be played on a touchscreen.
No.
When if you set out to do that, you can get some things that are really interesting. You know, once in a while somebody will do that, and then everybody else copies what they did.
Yes.
So you don't get a lot of iteration and innovation on that particular idea in that kind of scenario. I'm not as big of a fan of Apple's trend toward eliminating everything from phones, for example. I want a couple buttons on my phone, honestly. You know?
Oh, I see what you mean. Like, yeah, you want some physical tactile
stuff. The fact that they even turned the home button into just like an unmoving slab, it makes me annoyed.
But it's going to scan your face, Jonathan. It's going to
buying one of those.
Count your eyelashes and stuff.
No, I mean, that's it's not for me. I still at least want a home button. Here's the problem, though, right, is that certain classes of games were financially successful on mobile, and they were the ones about doing all these microtransactions, right? And so the reason now that people think mobile games aren't real games is because most of the very successful ones are not really about having a fun game. They're about having an excuse for these microtransactions to be there. Like, and it takes so much effort to do that well, but there's not that much effort left over to have an actual game there. You know, sometimes people do it a little better and are more successful in making something that's a game, and other times they're not. But I'm really not a fan of the designs that prey on the compulsive tendencies of human beings, right?
The feedback loop stuff.
Yeah, I think that kind of stuff is ethically and morally, well, dubious to say the least, but I would probably say something stronger than that. But I mean, anytime something is successful in a market like that, it's a little bit of a natural force, and it's not like I could do anything about that, right?
No.
So you see games that do it well, and I'm fine with games that do it well. Like, if you give me a way to pay for the game or support the developer, that involves the game being free, and then I can optionally do stuff. I mean, I'm good with that. It's just when it becomes a crass money farming manipulation of people that I get really bothered.
We do occasionally get the premium stuff pop up and do well. You mentioned Monument Valley, which is a nice example of something that broke through to the mainstream and was successful just by being a what would be considered traditional premium game, which you can complete in a short amount of time and doesn't go on forever and ever and ever. Which flies in the face of a lot of the models that are going around nowadays.
Right. And in fact, if that game had been released on PC or something, it might not have done as well because people would say, oh, it's too short or something, right?
Yeah.
But on mobile, it did great. So it's interesting, like, how these differences arise, and I never know what to expect.
Well, we're glad to see The Witness appear on mobile, which you can find on the App Store at the minute. And Jonathan, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me along.
Out and about this week, Warhammer Quest 2 has been anticipated for a bit. We liked the first one quite a lot, 2015. It was developed by Rodeo Games and was kind of a version of their Hunters game formula. Now it's been taken over by Pachang! And they have come out with a revamped version. You've got increased camera movement. You've got a more involved upgrade system for the characters. Everything looks a little bit shinier. But is it better? Well, Harry did the review for it. He thinks it's an improvement. He thinks it's built upon the original idea. It's taken its own direction a bit more. It feels like its own game. And he gave it a 9 out of 10 and thought it was cracking. I largely agree. With a few reservations. I do think it's a bit clunkier in places. I think it's got some UI issues. I think it feels a bit less polished than the first one, but it's also got a broader scope. So, you know, that might be why there are some slightly rougher edges. But if you've not played it at all, then top-down, grid-based RPG, a team of 2 to 4 characters guiding them around. You've got a number of action points for each character per turn. So click to move, and every tile you move costs an action point. Attacking with a mace or something costs 2, firing a little fireball thing might cost 3, and that's how you work your way through the dungeons, killing orcs and beasties and giant spiders and all that business. It's hard, it's punishingly tough. You have to make sure you do very clever character placements to make sure people are concealed, walk them out, fire at something, then make sure you've got an action point left to pull them back into cover, because enemies will just bear down on you and kick your ass, and you do not have a lot of healing potions, and be prepared, basically, for it to be a bit tough. I've seen some people complain about the fact that it's got in-app purchases available in the premium game. You don't need them at all, and I think what people are feeling is that it's hard, and therefore they feel like the game is trying to make them buy in-app purchases. I don't think that's the case, really. I just think it's tough. If you think back to the original was quite tough as well, and it didn't have any payments available, so don't worry about those. You can see the video review up on AppSpy. And yeah, broadly positive. Good job, Pachang. Carry on with your funny name. Glenn, you did the review of the game you were talking about last week, Fire Emblem Warriors.
Yes, I did. And I think I settled on a 7 out of
in the
10
end.
For it.
Yeah, if you want the full deep dive, listen to last week's episode because Glenn went in on it. But in summation, now you've got the final review thing up. What did we think?
Basically, it was kind of like what I was saying last week, how I feel like it's got a lot of Fire Emblem elements to it, but I just don't feel like it does enough to appeal to fans of like one of those franchises. Like you have to really like both of them to get the most out of it.
All right, and well, yeah, check out the review. Fire Emblem Warriors, mixed bag. Em, you've been doing cooking on iPhone, iPad?
iPad, yeah.
iPad. So what's the game called and what is it?
It's called Campfire Cooking, and it's a strategic puzzler where you follow a family out to the woodlands, which sounds dodgy, and you just kind of listen to them with their cutscenes, and then they're cooking food. There's different like tools to cook with on an open fire, and you've got to try and figure out how to cook everything perfectly without burning anything, and you know... It's good. It's really good. Like I kind of, when I first saw it, I really liked the art style, and I was like, I feel like this is going to be a good game. And now having played it, I was like, yes, it is. It was a good game. I'm pleased with it.
So the fire is represented by a grid.
You've got two sides of a marshmallow. Like the thing is, there's marshmallows and there's tubs of food and things. So the actual cooking time itself doesn't make a difference.
Okay.
But it's about getting the right char. So like your marshmallows, you've got two sides to it. Uh-huh. Every time you move your skewer, you know, left and right, it flips over.
Right.
And if you move it forward and backward, it just stays where it is.
Oh, okay.
So you've got to try and figure out how to flip your skewer around whilst also managing other things to then put it back over the flame and toast the other side without burning it, if you know what I mean.
Oh, I see. All right. And all the while you're having people telling stories in the background or something?
It's like you get, I don't know, 8 or so levels. And the thing is, the puzzles are really small, so they're really nice. It's not overwhelming. It's hard. Like, some of them are so hard, but not completely impossible to do. And then, like, every so often, you'll kind of come out onto the bigger picture where the grid is, like, in the center, but you've got the family sitting around it, so it's like it's a campfire. And then they just sort of exchange witty comments and stories and things like that, and it's just very pleasant.
It seems very sweet, very tranquil.
It is. And, you know, even though I was getting, like... Well, it's that thing, there's no timer and there's no sort of... Because it's a premium game, there's no sort of free-to-play elements in it or anything.
Yeah.
And it's just really chill, considering that it is so frustrating sometimes to try and think of the simplest goddamn solutions when you're just like, I don't understand!
And I'm burning my sausage!
I'm burning my sausage!
Okay, so, Campfire Cooking, that's iOS at the minute. It's £3.99 or $3.99. I'll have a look at this because that looks quaint. Push. This is a game from the guys that did Clocky and Hook as well. Basically, they're into these really incredibly minimal puzzlers. See, I liked Clocky, and this doesn't sort of stray too far from that format in terms of you're faced with a geometric object with a bunch of buttons on the side of it on a off-white background. And it's just like loads of blank buttons. And you're like, all right. What do I do? There's no prompt, there's no instruction. So you just go, I'll press a button, tick. All right, I press all the buttons, tick, 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 tick. And then when they're all pressed, it goes, doop, and then flies out the top of the screen. And you're like, nice. And then another shape flies down onto the screen. And that's the game. It's basically these objects with buttons on the side, and you have to press all of the buttons in order to get rid of the shape. However, as the game progresses, symbols start to appear on these buttons. So you'll get dots that appear. And you work out that one's got one dot, one's got two, one button's got three, and so forth. And you work out if you push them in order, one dot, two dot, three, four, five, boom. That's what solves the puzzle, and the thing disappears. If you push them in the wrong order, doesn't work. So you're like, oh, okay, I get this, I got it. Then symbols start appearing with, like, lines on them, so as if someone's dropped matchsticks on a table and it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you're like, aha, I know this. So you press the one that's got one stripe on it, then the one that's got two, and then it goes wrong, and you're like, oh, I thought I'd learned from that other one. And after a little while, you work out those ones with stripes, you need to press them in reverse order. So the one with five stripes you press first, then four, then 3, 2, 1, and then that eliminates the shape. So the trial and error kind of teaches you what the rules are for each particular shape. Then they start to mix the shapes together. Then entire new mechanics come in. So you get a button suddenly which appears, a little pink button where you press it and the shape spins like 90 degrees. And there's another side with more buttons. But during that spin, obviously, you can't see the original buttons you were looking at because you're now looking at the other side of the object. So you've got to start remembering, like, which one did I push first? So I pushed that one on this side, then flip it. Now I need to find the two, then flip it again. And it starts to get very confusing and brain explodey. I really like these type of games. I liked Clocky, and it does have this cool, detached minimalism to it, which I think people will either like or hate, as in, it can feel a bit sterile, and it's not got a lot of, like, warmth to it, but it's sorts of... And, you know, it's very Apple in many ways, where it's just, like, white and cool and sleek and stuff, but it's not full of character and charm and chuckles. But I like these games. They're very elegantly done. They're polished to within an inch of their lives. And it's only 99 pence, 99 cents. The review will be up on AppSpy. I recommend it. I like it. I think it's cool and clever. Go and have a look. Push is the name, all block capitals, and it's quite hard to find, to be honest with you. What else has anyone else been playing before I slag off Game of Thrones Conquest?
I played... What did I play? What's that game called that I mentioned? Oh, yeah, Rogue Trooper Redux.
Is this on the Switch?
Yes, it is. It's a remake of the PS2 shooter called Rogue Trooper. I don't know if you played it.
I have not.
So it's like a 2000 AD thing. It's one of those early sort of like muddy cover shooters on the PS2, which was quite ambitious at the time. And now they're sort of passing it off as a classic, and I'm not entirely sure it is a classic. But I think I'm enjoying it mostly on the basis that it's like very, very nostalgic of the period. Mm. Like, it's kind of broken. When characters speak, they... You know, their lips don't quite move in sync with what they're saying. Like, I really kind of like all that stuff.
Right.
the but yeah, basically, stuff. Exactly. It's kind of like a third-person cover shooter, standard one. Run into cover, you automatically stick to it sometimes. You shoot things, get different guns, upgrades, all that stuff.
Gotcha.
And it's fun. I like it.
Okay. Is it one of these cheapy, I assume, ones where you're, like, downloading it off the store?
No, I think it's got a... Actually, let me just double-check the price of it, because I don't think it is a cheapy one.
Ooh. While you check that price, I'm going to lay into Jon Snow and Daenerys Targaryen in their rubbish city-building form. I say rubbish, but as I say in the video, I've done a hands-on with it, and, like, it's just that these aren't for me, and this is feels like a particularly crass version of that game, where it's Game of Thrones... reskinned version of, you know, Clash of Clans. Like, that's what it is. It's got the worst intro, it's got the worst onboarding section to any game I've played in a long, long time, where you have the crap art that pops up the corner of the room with Jon Snow saying, oh, you joined the Empire, and oh no, I've got to go and fight a thing. And then a little crap looking creature pops up, and then you're represented by like a pawn, like chess pawn kind of object. And then this just like crap spear appears from its midsection and sort of spins around in the worst animation, and it goes like, ah, you have vanquished your foe. And it's like, what is this? What am I looking at? This is so bad. This is like sponsored by HBO. You've got a budget and this is terrible. As it turns out, when you push in, it looks a bit more like your standard city building thing, where you're just build a thing, upgrade it, get a reward, build a thing, upgrade, get a reward, again and again and again. And I just did that for 20 minutes. Like, just click the build, do the thing, get the reward. And it's just like, it hammered home even more than the usual iterations of this. I just don't get these games. They're not for me. I get no pleasure from it. It's really tedious. It's just busy work from beginning to end. And I don't understand anyone who likes this nonsense. The end.
People slammed.
Drawbacks.
That's right. Sam said that, I'll probably make loads of money because it's got Game of Thrones on it. How much is Rogue Trooper?
It is £20.
Ooh!
So it's a mid-tier one, isn't it?
That's the big releases for this week. I think we'll leave it there. But thanks for listening, everyone. You're great, you are. Especially you. You're the best of all
thanks,
the people.
James.
No, not you. Obviously not you. Edgelord Warlock, or whatever the hell your name is now. We will be back again next week for more chitter and chatter. But in the meantime, go and download some of the games that we said were nice and check out the reviews. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys.